Welcome to the Penn Faulkner Podcast. I'm Nate Brown, Deputy Director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and in episode 21, we bring you a recording from the 2013 Penn Faulkner Gala. Each year for the gala, Penn Faulkner brings together approximately a dozen authors, and we ask each of them to compose a brief piece of either fiction or nonfiction written to a single theme. Past themes have included confessions, the writing on the wall, a lesson, and journeys. And the list of authors who have participated is just incredible. T.C. Boyle, Rita Dove, Joyce Carol Oates, Gay Talese, Maurice Sendak, George Plimpton, Jane Smiley, Alan Greganis, Russell Banks, Alice Hoffman, Annie Dillard, Amy Tan, Tony Kushner, Chang Rayleigh, you get the picture. These authors and so many more have all participated in past galas, and this year's list of writers was no less impressive. The theme of the 2013 gala was renewal, and Penn Faulkner was honored to host writers Christopher Castellani, Matt Gallagher and Roy Scranton, Yi-Yun Lee, Anthony Mara, George Pelicanos, Mona Simpson, Christopher Tillman, Meg Wolitzer, Tiffany Yannick, Mary Kay Zarovlev, and Calvin Trillin, our Master of Ceremonies. The program opened with comments by Fraser O'Leary, president of Penn Faulkner's board of directors, and from Susan Richard Shreve, co-chairman of Penn Faulkner's board.
Welcome. I'm Susan Shreve, chairman with Bob Stone of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Tonight is a celebration of 25 years of friendship between writers and readers on this beautiful stage of the home we have at the Folger Shakespeare Library and on stages in schools all over the city. The first gala was Beginnings, the name from Eudora Welty's book, One Writer's Beginnings. And Eudora was among the writers on this stage that evening. In the book she did with Ron Sharp on friendship, she writes, "Did friendship between human beings come about in the first place, along with the inspiration of language? It can be safe to say that when we learn to speak and listen, rather than to strike or be struck by our fellow human beings, we found something worth keeping alive, worth possessing for the rest of our lives." To begin this round trip of thank yous, you'll see in your program Mary Haff's notes on the history of this gala, which began in friendship between the novelist Kate Lair and her next door neighbor, which I was lucky enough to be, and Kate's friendship with Carolyn Peachy, who with her amazing team is putting on this gala for the 25th time, and their friend, Elizabeth Stevens. Liz preceded the remarkable, generous, and deeply thoughtful Mary Haft as the chairman of the gala for the last several years. And thank you to our devoted co-hosts, Senator Thad Cochran and Senator Patrick Leahy, and all of the co-hosts, the board of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and our wonderful staff, and finally, to all of you seated in this theater who have made this evening a triumph of friendship, and to the writers who give of their time and imagination tonight and throughout the year. And now Fraser O'Leary, our president, who is a DC public school teacher at Cardoza High School, and who was the first teacher to take on Writers in Schools many years ago. He keeps us in line in much the way he deals with his students, with humor and affection and integrity. Thank goodness, Fraser O'Leary.
Thank you, Susan. Good evening and welcome. I became involved with the Penn Faulkner Foundation when a friend of mine recommended me to a program called Writers in Schools. Now, as it was then, it is the centerpiece of our foundation and a large part of what the gala and you support. Do you remember when you fell in love with books? It was probably long ago, in a land far away, or right around the corner. Tonight, we will be able to sit back and listen as the chosen ones, those people who will fill these seats for this year's gala, along with our student winner, Rachel Page, a sophomore at Wilson High School, take us to destinations which will amaze and entertain us with the power of their words. These writers spent the morning having conversations with our public and charter school high school students about their works and their lives. These visits, which take place all year long, provide the students with books and experiences which are unique and life-changing. This morning, I was fortunate enough to have Christopher Tillman in my class with two classes of AP students, and they spent an hour together that they'll never forget. Tonight, our master of ceremonies and tour guide is no stranger to our galas. His appearance has become an eagerly awaited annual event. He spent yesterday afternoon walking around parts of New York City, sampling the fare in a variety of restaurants and stores on his New Yorker festival tour. I'm sure a great time was had by all with the good food and great guidance. If you can imagine being guided by Calvin Trillin on the streets of New York. We are so glad he made it here to be with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Calvin Trillin.
Thank you, Fraser. I think of anybody who MCs here as somebody who is standing in for the late George Plimpton. As I've mentioned here before, one of the things I treasured about George was his accent, partly because he was the only one who had that accent. Person with less self-confidence than aplomb would suspect it was some sort of speech impediment. But George knew it was an accent. I have to admit that when I heard the theme for tonight's readings, renewal, the first thing that popped into my mind was renewing my driver's license. Not long after 9/11, I gave a little talk at the Brooklyn Library, and during the Q&A session, someone said, "Well, you fly an awful lot. Are you now worried about this?" And I said, "Well, what worries me is that I'm asked to show my identification so often, I'm afraid I'll lose my driver's license. You might say that I fear the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles more than I fear Arab terrorism." I've been eliminated as a terrorism suspect since I have reached the age where I'm no longer required to take my shoes off at the airport. I have mixed feelings about this. It's convenient, and of course you always hope that the guy tells you to take your shoes off. It's like a 36-year-old woman being carted at a disco or something. On the other hand, there's something dismaying about being certified as harmless by your own government. Oddly enough, they still make you take your belt off. And men of the shoe retention age, even with a belt, have trouble keeping their trousers up. You see them tugging all the time. they're afflicted with what I call DTS, which is disappearing touch syndrome. And an episode of it can be serious. I've heard that in Boca Raton, in one of those places that has an 8:50 buffet for anybody who gets there before 5, an otherwise respectable retired insurance adjuster from Paramus, New Jersey, walked right out of his pants. The shoe rule, as you may remember, comes from the attempt of Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber, to blow up a bomber. It was a fantastically inept attempt. He had the fuses hanging off of his sneakers. He practically asked the flight attendant for a match to. And according to the papers that went around England, talking to people who knew him, he was quite suggestible. But because of his attempt, the shoe rule was put in effect, even after I pointed out in a column that this was almost certainly a prank. My theory was that there was one Arab terrorist with a sense of humor. His nom de guerre was Khalid the Droll. And at one point, Khalid the Droll said to his cell, "I bet I can get them all to take their shoes off at Arab Way." So he recruited this bozo, and there we were. I said in that column that we'll know that my theory is correct if the next guy who was caught is, because of his MO, known as the underwear bomber. Sure enough. I mentioned that on a TV show, and when one of my grandsons was shown that through the miracle of TiVo, he said, "Babo said underwear on television." I'm still glowing from that. So now that I have started out the evening with discussion of posteriors and underwear, we will hear from about a dozen distinguished writers what I hope is a more elevated response to the subject of tonight's readings, renewal. Christopher Castellani.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Something happens when a word comes into your life, whether it's one you've heard 1,000 times, like, say, renewal, or one you finally looked up after years pretending you knew it, like, say, pulchritude. What happens is suddenly you see pulchritude and renewal everywhere, like they're taunting you and haunting you. And did you know there's a word for that too? The Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, it's called. You'll see that now as well, all over. Though beware, it's also the nickname of a left-wing militant terrorist group called the Red Army Faction, now supposedly defunct. I read an article. My point is, the brain craves patterns. It's bored with the useless data we bombard it with all day, which is why it lights up when it sees renewal on the jar of my mother's face cream, and why one night a few weeks back, I sat with her a while as she applied it to her once perfect, now corrugated skin. And when she says more to the mirror than to me, "What a waste," I know she means both the $48 cream, which I bought her, and does nothing. And she means the years that have snuck up on us both like a man in the dark, which is how he seemed to us on that night, her husband of 60 years, my father, pacing the hall, raging at the state, because just that morning I had driven the three of us to the DMV, Calvin. And there was that word again, renewal, on the form my mother and I filled out to calm him down, to make someone else reject it. Not us, but that mean lady behind the bulletproof window. Make her take his license away. Make her tell him, never again, sir, will you just get in your car and go. Roll the windows down, drink the air, leave your troubles behind, as you've done since that 54 Ford you bought the year you stepped off the boat, the year you met her at the port and drove her through her first city. I wish I could tell them both, neither of them know, that in May I'll be married 10 of my own years, with 50 or more I hope to go, and that my husband and I have been discussing the renewal of our vows. I'm telling you the words stalking me. That we thought a party this time, live music, but no gifts, no pressure, and how nice it would be to sit my father in the front row. How pulchritudinous my mother would look in a spring hat like the one she wore in the village at 16. The brain, it craves patterns, like the one the lines make from 54 to 14, from the old country to the new, stretching, deepening, like the lines in the corners of my own eyes. What a waste, that expensive cream. I bought a jar for myself. I wore it tonight. Thank you.
Matt Gallagher and Roy Scranton.
When I joined the Army, I was 25, unemployed, and living in my mom's basement. I dropped out of college 7 years prior, borrowed an old typewriter, defaulted on my student loans, and decided I'd be the next Hemingway. I worked as a dishwasher, caregiver, breakfast cook, carny, and truck driver. My writing went nowhere. After a bike accident wrecked my teeth and, having no health care, I couldn't afford to get them fixed, I made a choice and found myself driving a Humvee into Baghdad just after the 2003 invasion.
Like a lot of soldiers, I ended up becoming one because I wasn't supposed to. I was born into a class and in a time when someone else's kids joined the military. I wasn't a senator's boy or born with a silver spoon in my hand, but having two lawyers for parents made me fortunate son enough. After 9/11, though, I could see something like history with a capital H happening, and I'd read too many books to let that pass by. So, after 4 years of ROTC in college, I found myself in 2007 leading a scout platoon in Iraq. We'd be there for 15 months, doing what the history books now call the surge.
I had an easy war compared to some. What I never expected was how hard it would be getting out of the Army and moving to New York. Sometimes still I flash back to this party in Williamsburg, artisanal cocktails going off left and right. I was ambushed by a woman in enormous glasses explaining her participatory art project. And I can't even talk about what happened in IKEA. There were throw pillows everywhere.
After leading men in combat for 15 months, I figured my tough guy credentials were pretty solid. But when I got home, it was my tiny, ever-courteous mother giving orders. Politely implacable, she shocked and awed my sense of self-importance and surged me with concern. Suddenly, everything was checkpoints, timetables, and responsibility. I found myself daydreaming of the carefree days in Iraq.
And as we found apartments, went back to school, and made new friends, that's almost what the war started to seem like, a vague and distant dream. Something that happened to someone else, something that had nothing to do with life in America.
But the past, it doesn't go away. It's not a dream. It's what makes you who you are.
Some people think renewal is about wiping the slate clean. It's not. It's about learning to live with the things you've done.
Roy and I survived the peace by connecting our old lives to our new ones. We told stories. We found other veterans who understood our stories and who told us theirs. The stories of people like Jason, the spec ops trigger puller, grown numb to constant violence.
And Eric, a translator at Abu Ghraib who lives with the guilt of assisting in torture.
And Todd, shot in the face in the Battle of Fallujah.
And more. Those are just a few stories out of the more than 2.5 million veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and millions of Iraqis and Afghans whose lives were shattered by America's war on terror. A few stories like the ones we collected in our book, Fire and Forget, Short Stories from the Long War.
8 years in Iraq. Today, 13 years in Afghanistan. Even if the story we want to live and the story we want to tell is a story of renewal, it can't mean turning our backs on the past.
We put together Fire and Forget, and we're here tonight to call upon you, because we have to.
Remember.
Thank you.
Ye Yuen Lee.
This is a story that doesn't have renewal in it. The story is called The Egret. The new father said he had a Sunday brunch with friends. Sunday brunch, Auntie May thought. This man made it sound as though it was a luxury invented by Americans. Should she remind him that years ago, most families in China, possibly his too, would only have two meals on a Sunday, a brunch, an early dinner, to save a meal, Sunday brunch. The new mother sat at the table without touching the soup Auntie May had cooked, as she had prepared for many new mothers before this one. In fact, many were not accurate. In her interviews with potential employers, Auntie May always gave the exact numbers of families she had worked for as the first man's nanny. 126 when she had interviewed with her current employer, 132 babies altogether. These she had recorded in a palm-sized notebook, which had been taped back twice after falling apart. Years ago, she had bought the notebook at a garage sale in Moline, Illinois. She had liked the picture of the flowers on the front and the back, purple and yellow, unmelted snow surrounding the chaste petals. She had liked the price of the notebook, too, 5 cents. When she handed a dime to the child sitting astride a chair, not older than 8, she asked if there was another notebook like that, so he would not have to give back the change. The boy looked perplexed and said, no. It was greediness that had made her ask, but that memory came back. It often did when she took it out of the suitcase for another interview. Auntie May would laugh at herself. Why on earth do you want two notebooks when there's not enough life to fill one? I don't like this soup, said the new mother. It's not for you to like, said Auntie May. You eat for the baby. Why do I have to eat for him? Why indeed, Auntie May laughed. We eat not for ourselves, she wanted to remind the young woman. Your grandmother ate for your mother. Your mother ate for you. What right do you have to ask that question? I think I have postpartum depression, said the young woman. Between an azalea bush and a slated path, there was a man-made pond, which hosted lily pads with pink, white, and yellow blossoms and an assortment of goldfish. A statue of an egret stood on one leg above the water. Auntie May wondered how much it cost to buy a sculpture of such good quality. Where does your milk come if you don't eat? Auntie May said. I'm not a cow, the woman raised her voice. The egret took off with an unhurried elegance, the swooshing of the wings and the single squawk startling Auntie May. She picked up the crying baby and went into the yard. The pond was not entirely empty, so at least some goldfish had escaped. You think you have a problem with postpartum depression? Think of the goldfish living one day in a paradise pond, and the next day meeting their demise in the stomach of a passing by egret. Thank you.
George Pelicanos.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm Anthony Mara. I'll be reading a short piece about a man I met in Chechnya. In Urus Martan, Chechnya's southernmost city, Adam Satuyev has returned from Friday morning prayers at the local mosque. He's built like a bag of flour, with the calloused knuckles and cauliflower ear of a retired fighter. And in the moist, spoonable July heat, his linen shirt is translucent with sweat. "Follow me," he says, unlocking the gate to the lot stretching beside his home. For the past 20 years, as his neighbors have waged war with Russian soldiers in the nearby mountains, Adam has single-handedly constructed a monument to the traditional highland life vanishing around him. He quarried stone blocks from the mountains and built them into the multi-story watchtowers that once studded the surrounding peaks. He dug a well and routed the water through the lot to create irrigation canals, streams, and a lake. He erected a series of charnel houses and huts sheltered beneath summer foliage. Much of the design is based on his destroyed ancestral village, but he speaks of it not as a historian or a curator or even a survivor, but as an artist who has found in this hand-built village, peopled only by his ghosts, a kind of hope from reconstructing a world that war sought to dismantle. A low-slung wooden stable slouches near the end of the lot. "In Kazakhstan, I grew up in this stable," he says. In 1944, Adam's family was among the 500,000 Chechens deported to Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Siberia when Stalin declared the entire Chechen ethnicity traitorous. They lived in exile for 13 years. When they returned, they found the roads paved with fragments of the tombstones Soviet soldiers had uprooted from local cemeteries. Not far from the stable are the remains of several of those tombstones. Adam has reassembled them. If you visit Chechnya today, you cannot escape the locust hum of construction. The new Grozny is a marble sheen of promenades pasted over the ruins of its predecessor. The younger generation of Chechen drivers, to whom traffic laws are as foreign as the Pepsi products now populating kiosk coolers, enthusiastically disregard the freshly painted lane designations of newly paved roads. Today, families are returning from exile, as they had returned in 1956, when Khrushchev rescinded Stalin's order of deportation and allowed the Chechen people to return to their homeland. Adam's family had been among them. He was a child then. He was just beginning the life he would one day rebuild. Thanks.
Rachel Page.
You. The first stage of moth development is the egg. The first stage of cancer is a mutated cell. It went like this. As the larva of the moth built itself cell by cell behind the paper-thin curtain of its egg, your own cells replicated, divided, replicated again. They would not stop. In the middle of Minuet by Boccherini, you became suddenly tired and had to sit down. Keep playing, you told me, and watched from the piano bench as I moved into the trio, subito forte, suddenly loud. The second stage of moth development is a caterpillar. The second stage of cancer is a tumor. I found it on my way into your house for my lesson. Bright green on a rough, dark plain of asphalt, a caterpillar. I brought it inside to show you. It's beautiful, you breathed, and rushed into the kitchen to find a container for me to take it home in. Later, you sent an email to all of your students saying that you had been diagnosed with liver cancer. I am happy to talk to any one of you about this, you wrote, although I tend to cry on the telephone. The third stage of moth development is a cocoon. The third stage of cancer is metastasis. The caterpillar cocooned during the fall. Through the small holes that you had poked with a table fork, all I could see were wispy threads of silk, fine and gray like smoke, rising from the side of the plastic container. On Thanksgiving Day, you celebrated your marriage at your parents' house in the country. You and your husband had been living together for 5 years, but you told us that the time seemed right to make it official. The cocoon stayed the same throughout the winter. Eventually, I stopped checking on it. You canceled your lessons, emailed students telling them to find new teachers, drove back and forth between DC and New York for chemo. You were tired all the time, you told me, so tired you could barely walk from the bedroom to the kitchen and back again. The fourth stage of moth development is the adult moth. The fourth stage of cancer is remission. It went like this. First one wing broke through the threaded wall of silk, then another. I went outside one morning to find a body inside the plastic container, wings emblazoned with two eyes that smoldered at me like embers. When I went to visit you at your house, I brought you a picture of the moth, unfolded like a book against the white of the container. You ran your finger over the printed ink, the dark outline of the wing. Your hair was growing back, short and stubbly, gray now, as if you'd aged years instead of a few months. We're taking a break from treatment, you said, trying to decide what to do next. This is what I remember, how your hair stood straight like blades of grass, stretching, new.
This is really George Pelicanos.
Thank you. Thank you for your support of Penn Faulkner and the Writers in Schools program. A writer walks down a brightly lit corridor in the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He's in the research phase of a book that has yet to come alive. Something about rebirth and reawakening and coming to terms with a dark decade that's nearing its end. Today he's been talking to recovering veterans, injured soldiers and Marines, volunteers, physical therapists, and shrinks. What he's seen has been both disturbing and inspiring. He's used to this sort of thing. It's work. He comes to a bank of elevators. A middle-aged man stands before the closed doors holding the grips of a wheelchair. In the wheelchair is a pretty young woman with short black hair and bright blue eyes. She's probably 19 or 20 years old. She's got a hint of a mustache that's been shaved and is coming back. It's hard to discern her size as both of her legs have been amputated high on the femur, just below her trunk. Because of this,
She seems as small as a child. The stumps of her legs are exposed. One stump twitches wildly, involuntarily. The other is still and has been badly burned and scarred with dots, bits of shrapnel permanently embedded in the skin. Both she and the man, whose eyes are the same shade of striking blue, smell of freshly smoked cigarettes. The elevator car takes a long time to arrive. "How's it going today?" says the writer, realizing how lame the words sound as they leave his mouth. But the girl lets him off the hook and says with enthusiasm, "Great." "We just come from the fitting room," says her father, in an easy, deep South way. "My daughter's going to get her new legs soon. Come summer," she says, "I'm going to swim in the reservoir back home. Right, Daddy?" "Baby girl," says the father, "I believe you will." He's smiling, but his upper lip trembles as he speaks. He pulls on her hospital gown, where it slipped off her shoulder, and puts it back in place. The elevator car has yet to arrive. "I'm going to take the stairs," says the writer, adding stupidly, "You all have a good one." And the father says, "You do the same." The writer uses the exchange, fictionalized, with new dialogue in the book he'll eventually write. He's a mercenary in that way. Some might say a vampire, but he doesn't forget. 6 years later, the young woman and her father are still in his head, and the writer often wonders, did she swim? Later that same year in Southeast, a 17-year-old boy, James, sits in a circle at the DC jail with other young men, all of them wearing orange jumpsuits. They're housed in a special block holding juvenile offenders who've committed serious crimes. When they turn 18, they'll transition into the federal prison system as adults. Today, a writer has come to visit them. He's wearing a summer blue sport jacket tailored in Italy. He's telling them that they can do anything once they set their minds to it, that life is long, to not let their past mistakes keep them down. James and his fellow inmates have heard this advice from visitors many times before. The writer gives them a few words, something to do with home, and tells them to go away for 10 minutes and come back with a poem. James goes into another room and stares at a lined yellow pad, an ink pen in his hand, and he concentrates. He thinks of his Aunt Sandra, a church-going woman who visits him every week. She lives over there in Prince George's County, and she has promised him a room in her house when he's released. James begins to write. 10 minutes later, he and the other boys return to take their seats in a circle, and one by one, they begin to read their poems. When it's James's turn, he hesitates. He has a slight stutter that's gotten better over time. It was real bad when he was a kid. It stopped him from speaking up in class, plus he had that attention thing. James feels that his learning problems set him behind the other kids at school. That's what led him into trouble, and those boys he ran with. The writer looks directly at James and says, "Let's hear what you wrote about home." James stares at the yellow pad and reads the words he's put down. "Waiting for someone to find me, all alone with no one beside me. I'm stuck with a broken compass and an intoxicated mind. I can't tell right from left, up from down. I've been placed in the lost and found. But one day a caring heart came to show me my way, fix my broken compass, detox my mind, and showed me my way home." After, when the writer has shaken everyone's hand before he rushes out of there, he says to James, "You've got talent." James asks the writer if he can stay in touch with him, maybe get his email address. But the writer tells me he doesn't give that out. "I'll come back and visit you guys," he says. Maybe he does come back, but James will never know. 2 months later, he's shipped out to Marion, the federal joint in Illinois. There, James keeps to himself when he can and takes out books from the prison library. He thinks on that writer's sport jacket, how the fabric looked nice and expensive. He bets the man drives a real sweet car. Maybe James will become a writer someday too, but in lockup, it seems like a real long hill to climb. How do you get there from here? He dreams on that sometimes, but mostly he thinks of that room he's going to have in his Aunt Sandra's house over there in PG County. That's where he's going to start from when he starts out new. Thank you. Thanks.
Mona Simpson.
Thank you.
Hey, this is a story called Re-Upping. What I like has changed. When I was first ordained, I was a bachelor. Those years, I went in for the big ticket acts of ministry, the weddings, births, and funerals. I suppose you could have said I had a life in need of drama. I did eventually marry, but Melissa and I have little drama. And our drama tends to be the quiet kind, more like a small contemporary novel, less like Dostoevsky. I mind the funerals now because the congregants whose eulogies I have to write are people I know. Speaking at the burial of someone you took walks with, or even someone who came once a year to rebalance your fidelity account, is trying for a faith as thin and fragile as mine. Baptisms became harder too, with every year Melissa failed to conceive. Now that we sponsor the local chapter of FCFCWME, Foster Care for Children with Medical Emergencies, I know how many kids there are housed here in a vacant office building, at the same time twins are born to couples who've paid tens of thousands to conceive them. I've even lost my taste for weddings. Years ago, I loved a party. I hoped to meet a woman, and in fact, I did meet Melissa at a wedding I officiated. Beforehand, I asked brides and grooms to talk to each other about their family involvements, their ways of spending money, and their needs for physical intimacy. Still, having graduated from my course of prenuptial counseling, more than half the couples I married are already divorced. Quite a few of them came to me to get counseled for that too. What I favor now are the renewal of vows, usually matched up with a silver anniversary so that everyone who needs to fly in comes for the one big party. Just this weekend, I had a new request. One of my congregants had asked for an appointment. She brought along her ex-husband. They said they wanted a ceremony too, a re-upping. Well, what are you renewing, I joked, the wedding vows or the divorce judgment? They didn't laugh. Neither exactly, he told me. He said it had to do with the ring that he had given her when she was 20. They both wanted it to be their daughter's someday, but they thought it would mean more if she, the mother, started wearing it now, and they believed that required some sort of blessing or spell. It had first been an engagement ring. It had to turn into something else. Now that we've been divorced longer than we were married, he said in my office, I can finally tell you I was wrong to leave. She sighed. There are things I've missed too these years. You never stayed mad long. You were kind of buoyant. What they renewed today in my presence was a commitment to the kindness in which they'd raised a daughter, a kindness that had lasted when other things had not. This was their grace. They had remained friends. Thank you.
Christopher Tillman.
Thank you. You know, none of my fellow readers have wasted a lot of time with thanks, but I have to just thank the Penn Faulkner Foundation and tell you what you all know is this is an absolute jewel of a literary organization, and I'm so proud that it's here in Washington, D.C. It's what this young city does best. So thank you to the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I have a work of fiction. I won't dignify it by calling it a story. Therefore, I have to give it a title, though, so I'll call it Act One, which should make you realize that there's maybe more. I was playing squash with my friend Rich, and he broke his racket in the first 10 minutes. He went off to get a loaner from the Lost and Found, came back to the court empty-handed, and settled down beside me. He told me that he and he alone had exhausted the supply. He has a loud voice, especially when feeling accused, and it boomed in the cube of the squash court. Margaret and I are having trouble, he said. You're always having trouble. It's the key to your marriage, I answered. Yes, she says it's systemic. But now she says that a good marriage is not about the present, but about the future. She says that as long as a married couple agree where they want to end up, then they know they are aligned and it makes good sense to muddle through. I told her I didn't know where I wanted to end up, just alive, somewhere. I said. As usual, Margaret's theory seemed worrisomely quantitative, but was worth considering. Well, where does she want to end up? He groaned. He did not look all that healthy, as if the end for him was nearer than either of us wanted to admit. He was still sweating alarmingly, and we'd only played a few points before he smashed his racket. October in Vermont is a must for her. It's non-negotiable. Winter in a city, any city with a professional opera company. Summers on the road. On the road, like renting an RV? No, on the road is a concept. It's about renewal. It's her way of saying we have to keep remaking ourselves to the end. She wants that written into the contract. Sounds exhausting, I said. Exhausted, and wondering whether my retirement account at TIAA CREF would allow such a lifestyle. Well, how did you answer that? I told her I didn't believe in the concept of renewal, that it was a myth, the golden bough and et cetera, that it was just a way of selling cosmetics and gym memberships. All we can really do with our lives is rearrange the furniture from time to time, which didn't go over very well. No, he said. We sat quietly. It was pleasant to rest here in the immaculate shine of a squash court while others huffed and puffed, shouted and cursed all around us. Squash is a horrible and unprincipled game. How about you, he asked. I wondered. Of the two arguments, I had more sympathy with Margaret's. Being on the road sounded like more fun than rearranging furniture. But what I didn't like was the geometry of her thinking, an upward arc with its bursts of renewal at the end like a fireworks display. Her idea of renewal seemed wasteful to me. Nothing to show for 30,000 days of existence but scattered ash. I have lived a very ordinary life, but every minute of it seems worth gathering, binding up, preserving, bringing home. A safe harbor is what I am after, a pleasure both going out and coming back. At last I said to Rich, I guess if anything, I'd like to end up back where I started, myself only purer. I want to keep becoming myself only better. I renew myself every time I stop to reflect on this private journey I am taking. In this light, I am astonished by what has happened to me. What would she say to that? Rich pondered for a while, and then he said, does where you started have a professional opera company? Thank you.
Meg Wolitzer.
As you can see, each of us here has been asked to speak very briefly. So what I have to say will be so economical and will go by so swiftly that it'll feel like one of those abridged classic novels that kids read, you know, the ones that go like this. All happy families are alike. But Anna Karenina's family was different. They had some problems. Look out, Anna, here comes a train, the end. It's hard to write about a subject that's been given to you because it's working from the outside in. This is so different from how I was raised as a writer, which was basically write whatever comes into your head. And I had a first grade teacher, Mrs. Gerby, who used to invite me up to her desk to dictate stories to her because she could write them down faster than I could. And I'd be like a big executive and she'd be my secretary. Take a letter, Mrs. Gerby. But tonight, there are rules. I feel a little bit like I'm on an old game show. The password is renewal. So when I really free associated about the word, I was reminded of that great Grace Paley short story in which the narrator finally takes her very overdue books back to the library.
Paley writes, "The librarian said $32 even, and you've owed it for 18 years. So she returns the books and pays the fine, and then guess what she immediately does with the books? She renews them. Now, when I read this story for the first time, I was very young, and my mother, Hilma Wallitzer, who's also a writer and was on this stage last year, handed me the book and said, 'Read this.' And it blew me away. Everyone in this room has renewed books and has also been renewed by books. I'm no different. I grew up on Long Island in the town of Syosset, which I like to refer to by its Native American name, Exit 43. I was very proud of having a mother who was a writer, though it really does not always have that effect on children. When my own son was 5, we were walking down the street in New York, and we passed a McDonald's, and there was a sign that said, 'Now hiring,' and he pointed and said, 'Look, Mom, look, you could do that.' He thought that what I did was maybe a little bit suspicious, but I loved that my mother was a writer, particularly when we went to the library, where the checkout person would always let our family take out as many books as we wanted. And I'd saunter up to the counter with my big stack, making sure everybody in the library was looking. I think I had a demented fantasy that my family was seen as a sort of Jewish, bookish version of the Kennedy family strolling around Hyannisport. And here's the thing, when those books were overdue, unlike the Grace Paley character in that story, we didn't even have to pay a fine. The desire to renew books, to take your time with them, to read them again and again and again, is the very same human desire that we all have in life, to keep the story going, to find a way that it never has to end. Thank you.
Tiffany Yannick.
It's such an honor to be here in support of writers and readers, and especially young writers and readers, and to be among all of you who are doing the same. It's a real special honor to have heard Rachel Page make her debut as a young writer. Girl, I thought you kicked ass. Thank you to Penn Faulkner, and a special thank you to Nate. I'm reading fiction. A church is burning down. On a Caribbean island in the countryside, up a road that might lead to a saving beach, but does not, a church is burning down. Everyone who is associated with this church will think, my church is burning down. But for now, there are only two women, Deirdre and Violet, there to look at the fire and blame each other. They are both American women in the middle of their lives. They and their families are members of this church. They are each married to a local man, both of whom are skinny and frail of body. These women, they want to be the strong ones, and they have always been the strong ones. Deirdre has brought the garlands for the church stairs. She has brought the pew pins and the flowers for the altar. She was the first to arrive and see the bright flames. She is already dressed in her gold silk suit. She saw the smoke from far away in her car, but she imagined that some filthy native was burning garbage in his yard. The smoke seemed to disappear as Deirdre drew near the church, but this was an illusion. My father killed himself just like this. That is what Violet says. Even though she only meant to think it, it is not something that she has said to anyone, and now she has said it to the fire and to Deirdre. She is almost hysterical with tears. There really is a church, her church, burning right in front of her, right here on this island that was supposed to be brown skin paradise. The suicide is a secret that Violet has kept from her husband and her daughters. Her parents are dead. Her children are told honorable stories. They do not seem to mind that they don't know their white cousins, and Violet has been grateful for that indifference. She sees that Deirdre is standing before the church as though just watching is serious work, as though the burning might be her own doing. Deirdre, who is chubby and unhappy and dangerously insecure. Violet cannot remember ever touching Deirdre, even in the peace during church services, but now she thinks that the goodly thing to do would be to move toward Deirdre, closer to the flames, so they can work this fire out as a team. Violet hugs the ring pillow to her chest protectively. The wedding bands are sewn gently on. She gives her voice as an offering. My mother died in the fire too. They never said suicide, but it was. And though Violet is crying, the words are very clear. But Deirdre does not move at all. And for a second, Violet thinks that she should step forward and hug this woman. But then it comes to her like a pinch that Deirdre is the arsonist. That self-righteous cow would love to see Violet's daughter sullied. She clenches her jaw and takes a breath. Deirdre can burn for all she cares. Instead, she asks, can you at least fucking tell me if our children are inside? Between Deirdre and Violet, there is more than a fire. There is something more destructive. It is something like history and the future converted into flesh. They have children between them. And now they have their similar histories and their new futures, like a leash from one to another.
Mary Kay Zuraloff.
Thank you so much for coming and for supporting Penn Faulkner. We were raised to walk on eggs. Just taking a shower, there are a half dozen ways to crack open the day. You might forget to turn the bathroom fan on, allowing the mirror to fog up. Or you might forget to turn the fan off. Honestly, you could get in trouble with my father 6 ways before breakfast. After the yelling stopped, there might be an hour or a week of silence aimed your way. If, against your family's wishes, you become a writer, it is your job to trace those eggs back to the coop, in this case, back to an old believers community in Erie, Pennsylvania. In a house above the train tracks, where the breezes carry the stench of the paper mills, there are 11 children whose illiterate father works in a factory and whose mother, though born here, lost her U.S. citizenship when she married a Russian national. That's how it was in 1908. She was 14 then, and beginning at 15, she had a child every 2 years, except for the year she had two identical twin girls right in the middle. In 1931, my father was the 11th. And the rare stories he tells are of being whipped with a leather strap his father had braided for that purpose, but also of ice skating on Lake Erie while his father fished beneath the lake's crust for walleye. The pike froze as soon as my grandfather pulled them out and laid them on the ice. After he took them home to a barrel of water in the basement, they swam again. And when my grandmother wanted fresh fish for dinner, he'd crack the film of ice in the barrel and grab one for her. My father attended a technical high school for hoodlums, one relative told me, so he would have a trade. But he also ended up going to Princeton because of his astonishing basketball talent and raw intelligence. Years later, when my father offered his parents a trip home, my grandfather said, "Why would I want to go there? I fled from Russia." He actually said that in Russian because he stopped speaking English after he retired. And he spent most of his time at the Orthodox Church, which was modeled on the one back in Russia. On visits to Erie, we'd go with him, though the bearded men in Russian shirts stood on the opposite side from the women in headscarves and floor-length skirts. Standing next to my mother through the entire service, which was chanted in Slavonic, I'd watch two boys on library ladders light row after row of icons. Once all the wicks were lit, they'd begin snuffing them out, one by one. While my parents battled poverty and prejudice, our biggest hurdle was avoiding my father's baffling rage. Family vacations were especially dicey and put him on edge. You were to get yourself and your packed duffel in the car, or the car would leave without you. If you forgot something, improvise. And that included toothbrush or underwear, because we would not be wasting time or money when we had toothbrushes and underwear at home. I tell you this to explain why I objected when my husband proposed a summer trip to St. Petersburg, Peter the Great's capital city. I pointed out that Peter the Great tortured and drove out the Russian Orthodox priests before he tortured and then killed his own son. My husband suggested that what happened in the 18th century stay in the 18th century. He said, "Don't you want to see your homeland?" Frankly, I was afraid of my homeland. I was afraid that some capricious authoritarian would not let me in, or that another would not let me out. I would get in trouble or lost, and not speaking the language, I would not be able to get help, or a toothbrush, or underwear, should I forget to pack them. Russia was a family trip back to the ground zero of family. I told our daughter, gently, our tentative plans, and she said, "St. Petersburg, cool beans." That was my first indication I was overreacting. I told my mother, expecting her usual refrain, "Those people love to suffer." Instead, she said, "I am so jealous." While we offered to take her, she did not think she could manage. In fact, the airport was the mob scene I had feared, and I held tight to my daughter's sleeve. "Mom," she assured me, "no one is going to get left behind." As soon as we checked into the hotel, she locked our passports in the room safe without punching in a password, so they were secure, but irretrievable. I confessed our error to the stern desk clerk, who actually smiled. "You are not the first to do this," he said. Encouraged, we headed into the city, sounding out the Cyrillic to find a restaurant, the Bronze Horseman, and even Band-Aids we had neglected to pack. Our week-long adventure was a joy, though Russian history was not. Peasants and royals alike had many children, but few lived past the age of three. Both Peter the Great and Ivan the Terrible killed their sons, and most of the czars were assassinated. Which brings me to the Church of the Savior on Spilled Blood. Built atop the cobblestones where Alexander II was killed by a bomb, the church is 81 meters tall to mark the year of his death, and its enameled onion domes are more Disney than godly. But through the thick wooden door is the largest array of mosaics on earth. Glass shards depict Jesus being tortured and killed, each of the martyred apostles, and Russia's brutalized saints, surrounded by angels, angels, angels. I passed detailed images of the worst thuggery and the most excellent beneficence. That such cruelty and artistry exist side by side frees up something inside me. And I see, tears in my eyes, that they have let me in, and they will not keep me. I will walk through this graphic novel of a church, and I will walk out the back door with my ensuite family. And here is the renewal I never expected. Here is the great joy, too, in travel, one that has previously been unto me the very joy of writing fiction, where anything can happen. Just as in America, one exits the church on spilled blood through the gift shop. I bought my father a t-shirt of the Romanov dynasty, which it turned out he loved, and my mother and myself each an enameled egg, the fragile symbol of so many things, including rebirth and renewal. Thank you.
want to thank all of our readers, even those who didn't mention the Motor Vehicle Bureau. That's the reading part of the 25th Penn Faulkner Gala. Now the eating part will happen. I hope you can all join us and join us again. Next year we'll be open even if they're closed. Thank you.
As you might imagine, hosting the gala is a big endeavor, and it takes so many people to make it possible. We'd like to thank the co-chairs of our gala committee, as well as all of the members of the gala committee, and our entire board of directors for making it all possible. We also owe a debt of gratitude to our longtime friends and partners at the Folger Shakespeare Library for making this annual event possible. Mostly, we want to thank this year's participating authors for joining us, and a special thanks to Rachel Page, a student at Wilson High School here in D.C., who won this year's gala essay contest and who you heard read in this episode. Another special thanks to Benedict Cupstis, who composed the music heard in this episode. Our reading series underwriters helped Penn Faulkner further its mission of bringing readers and writers together. This year, they include Hill's Kitchen, a specialty kitchen store just off the Eastern Market stop in D.C., Sonoma Restaurant in the Capitol Hill neighborhood, the New York State Summer Writers Institute at Skidmore College, Aegean Arts Circle, which offers small and intensive writing workshops each summer in Andros, Greece, and New York University's MFA program, as well as their new low-residency MFA program in Paris, France. If you'd like to learn more about how you or your business can help support Penn Faulkner, please visit us online at www.pennfaulkner.org/support or give us a call at 202-898-9063.